Your North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, the Independent, read today by John Federson. The issue is dated February the 12th of 2026. It's a long issue today, plenty of political election-related stuff, and so I'd best get to it. The first article, very short, it's actually an open letter to the readers from the publishers of Indie Week. Dear readers, Indie's identity as a newspaper has many layers. To some, it's their go-to source of local music, arts, and culture coverage. To others, it's where they find coverage of town council, their neighbors, and local issues, and many know it as the place to send a letter to the editor to make their voice heard, or where they got their first byline as a young journalist. For 40 years, Indie has also had another element, influential political endorsements. There has always been tension between doing great journalism and making endorsements in races. In the past, with other strong outlets around, Indie could stake out a lane that did both. But given the gaping local news void today and our own limited resources, we see our main priority as filling the vast need for original, rigorous reporting on those races. That's why, as we've talked through our plan for this year and beyond, we've come to the decision to step away from that role and end political endorsements. The decision comes with mixed emotions. Stepping away from any long-standing tradition is hard. We know readers have relied on the clarity and accessibility of our endorsements as they navigate local elections, and we're committed to continuing our sharp and clear election analysis. But making endorsements makes taking an institutional position on which candidates we find best, which can undermine reader trust in the fairness of our reporting. It also saps our journalists' time and resources that could be spent on reporting insightful and in-depth news about those races, which we think is the most important work we can do right now when it comes to supporting democracy and informing readers. We believe there are lots of local political organizations with strong voices. We believe there are far too few local journalism organizations with capacity and depth to uncover the facts and backstories that keep you informed. Our attention will be focused on providing reporting, analysis, and candidate questionnaires that keep readers informed about key elections and help them make the best decisions when they go to the polls. The change will set us up to do more journalism, convene more conversations, and be a catalyst for nuanced debate about the Triangle's biggest issues. This week, we hosted 75 engaged Durham readers for a public conversation about how to make the region's big job announcements work for every resident in the city, not just new arrivals. In January, we hosted 150 curious folks in Cary for a public launch event of our new three-time-a-week reporting newsletter for Western Wake County, a new initiative to fill the yawning gap in local news coverage across a complex and interesting swath of the Triangle. At a time when national outlets like the Washington Post are cutting hundreds of journalists, we're adding staff. Indie's team of full-time editors and reporters is larger than 3 years ago when it first joined the Assembly Network. That's a local-owned group of outlets across North Carolina that focus on in-depth reporting on power and place. Moving forward, you'll see us leaning into political reporting like our definitive piece on the Fouché Alam congressional primary race, foundational reporting on the race to succeed Lauren Freeman as Wake District Attorney, and comprehensive work on the contested state Senate primary in Durham and a House swing district in southern Wake County. This election cycle, Indy's team interviewed nearly 50 candidates and is on track to publish about 30 election stories in addition to over 80 candidate questionnaires before primary day in our quest to inform Triangle voters. We want to hear your thoughts on this change and our focus moving forward. Here's where to email us, backtalk, one word, backtalk, at indyweek.com. And we're excited to do more local reporting that holds power to account and helps make a complicated place easier to understand. With thanks, Kyle. And that is Kyle Villemain, the founder of the Assembly Network. That's that independent group of news outlets that includes the Indy, as well as statewide and regional teams across North Carolina. And I might parenthetically say that often I simply read the story. I don't tell which other journal is responsible for the story. It appears in the Indy Week, so I read it. If it looks like I should do it, if it's worded in the story, I'll let you know. All right, well, let's get on to a story then. Well, folks, John Fetterson again. The upshot of this new change in policy with saving some of the work of the correspondence to recommendations and endorsements now does mean that the individual stories might be longer and therefore take longer to read. I have to judge as I go on in reading this journal how many of them I have time to read in the hour of this show. So, here we go with the first one. We talked to all 12 Durham School Board candidates, so you don't have to. To be a Durham School Board member is to bear a monstrous amount of responsibility. Yes, education for 30,000 kids, but also managing a workplace for over 5,000 employees and stewarding the tax dollars of over 340,000 residents while having almost no power to actually do anything. Need more money or a new school building? Go beg the county commission to raise taxes even more. Don't like how the district administration is handling something? Go complain to the superintendent, your one employee, and hope he doesn't follow a trend of superintendent turnover and leave for another district in a state that actually funds education. Want to take a principled stand for progressive values like Chapel Hill Carborough's school board chair did? Enjoy getting your ass dragged before a state legislature hell-bent on prosecuting a culture war rather than passing a budget to, say, pay teachers fairly. That'll be the reality for whichever four candidates can win seats on the DPS Board of Education in the March primary. Durham is split into four districts, and each board member is elected only by the people in that district, so check your registration to see who will be on your ballot. This is also a nonpartisan general election, not a primary, so you won't see these names again in November. For this election, the Durham Association of Educators, the district's majority member union, endorsed a slate of candidates early in the campaign season and helped them land the coveted local People's Alliance endorsement. We, by the way, had previous coverage for more information on who the major PACs have endorsed. All four endorsees have insisted they would be independent decision makers, but a DAE sweep would certainly give the union some leverage in this nascent meet-and-confer experiment, which gives the union a seat at the district decision-making table and has often been contentious. Board members will also have to calculate how much leeway they want to give to the superintendent, who has something of a mixed hiring record so far. Parentheses, CFO Jeremy Teeter has gained a near-universal acclaim for his work in untangling the district's messy finances. Deputy Superintendent Tanya Giovanni was recently accused of obstructing justice. And the board is set to lose at least 23 years of experience, of the four incumbents whose seats are up for election, only one is running for re-election. Each of these four districts has three candidates, and we spent our January getting to know all 12 of them. In covering local elections, we've occasionally encountered candidates who should clearly never be trusted with any kind of power. Well, this does not appear to be one of those elections. And we asked them about their priorities, experience, and how they imagine themselves working with the DAE, administrators, and parents. And here's our rundown of the 12 DPS candidates. District 1. Dilsey Burton is an assistant attorney general for North Carolina's Department of Justice. She has a list of agenda items she'd bring to the board, including changing the DPS holiday schedule to match the more inclusive New York City school calendar. As a state-certified mediator, Burton says she's qualified to help get all the right people talking about how to fix DPS's various issues. She's also pushing for full budget transparency and teacher pay, arguing the DPS needs to fairly compensate its workers if it wants to provide students with the best possible outcomes. She's particularly interested in, yes, trying to get more money from the state, but also in trying to better leverage grants and relationships with private companies in order to get the most possible funding for DPS. David McLellikian is first vice chair of the Durham Democratic Party and the owner of a custom home building company. He studied operations management and finance and worked in corporate finance before leaving to start his own business. While he doesn't have education experience, he brings a strong understanding of infrastructure, which will be relevant as the board weighs its massive deferred maintenance costs from recent years. He's also eyeing sites like the soon-to-be-defunct Durham School of the Arts campus for ideas, including a trade education program or even renting the property to help DPS find a little more revenue. Natalie Bent-Kataif has a background in research and public health. She describes her view of public schools as hubs of community as well as places of learning, which she sees as especially important in 2026. She's been involved in organizing an advocacy around her children's schools, including a push to bring back the social-emotional learning curriculum, and is interested in bringing more resources and attention to the DPS schools that don't necessarily have the best reputations or rankings. With strong family ties to labor organizing, she says she wants to see the meet and confer process continue in good faith from both the union and administrative sides, and she has also gained endorsement from most of Durham's major PACs. I'll just pause this actual reading to mention there are one-paragraph quotes from each of these candidates, which I am leaving out of the reading, just to test how long the process this will be. So these can all be found, folks, if you went to IndyWeek, and looked at the online version of this article. That's where I'm reading all these from, IndyWeek.com. Okay, District 2, Bettina Umstead, is finishing her second full term on the board and is the current chair. She previously served as chair from 20 to 24. She previously worked at education nonprofit Student U and the Equity Collaborative and was recently appointed to the Governor's Advisory Council on Student Safety and Well-Being. Umstead is highlighting that in her tenure, the County Commission has consistently increased its financial support of DPS and that she has continued to push for raises for staff each year. Umstead will have to convince voters that she is responsible for the positives of her tenure while sidestepping the high-profile messes. She could make a compelling case for experience given that she is the only one of the four incumbents who has chosen to run again. Then, Rachel Waltz, a program manager currently working with Community Solutions. She previously worked at Orange County Housing and Community Development. As a social worker, she says she has a clear understanding of the challenges that students and parents may be having at home that impact how they show up to school. She says the best way for DPS to rebuild trust is to actually listen to the community and implement changes based on those suggestions. She's worked with various levels of government in her day job, says she is prepared to build coalitions, both on the board and off, to respond to the district's challenges. She's jumping into the election this year because she was disappointed by the district's response to federal immigration officials showing up in Durham. Nadine Beer, BIR, is the Director of Finance and Human Resources at Press On, a media collective, and a co-founder of Mothers for Ceasefire. She sees her work in finance and HR as directly relevant to the issues the DPS is facing, with the budget problems and recent indictment of several administrators. Beer is running partly because she saw a lack of unity during the recent immigration enforcement crackdown, while she would have liked to see a uniform stance and training for staff. She's particularly interested in teacher retention via improving pay, as well as meeting some of the stated needs of the DAE, like biweekly pay instead of monthly, which the union and administration have recently stalled over. To District 3, Peter Crawford is a candidate and a co-founder and head of operations at real estate startup Acre. He has three children currently in DPS schools and has worked as PTA treasurer and served in special operations in the Army. Crawford's arguing that he is equipped to bring board members together to build governance structures to avoid scrambling from crisis to crisis. Like many candidates, Crawford says he was motivated to run after seeing the district fumble a promised 2024 staff pay increase that it then had to walk back. He says that he wants to help steer the board to set achievable goals for the superintendent to reach. He's not registered with a political party, but his detractors may note that he voted in Republican primaries over the past 10 years. He says he was doing his, quote, small part to try to steer the party away from Trump. Next for District 3, Lauren Sartain, a professor of K-12 education policy at UNC Chapel Hill. She's also an E.K. Powell parent and the former PTA president of that school. In her day job, she has helped districts like Chicago Public Schools to navigate some of the same financial and logistical issues that have plagued DPS. She has previously pushed DPS to adopt zero-based budgeting, which rebuilds an annual budget from zero, rather than from the previous year's allocations. As a self-described policy nerd, she's promising to use her professional experience to chart a data-driven path forward for the district. She also has a unique reputation in DPS circles. She's aware that some administrators may not be a fan of her sharp comments at school board meetings and in emails to officials, but she says she's just not afraid to ask the tough questions. Next, Gabby Rivero is the founder of a therapeutic dance company, and she certainly currently serves on the state. She currently serves on the city's Recreation Advisory Committee. She has been an advocate for children since her undergraduate years, when she built a nonprofit around providing students with access to arts, and often mentions her focus on finding root causes of behavior and issues. In her campaign, she described how being a black mother with half Puerto Rican children has informed her perspective on DPS's equity and achievement gap, which countless iterations of the board have struggled to address. She has promised to focus on communicating about DPS prestigious magnet programs to black and Hispanic families that may not know about them. Rivero, in a high-energy interview, also called out DPS's response to increased immigration enforcement last year, arguing the district should be more outspokenly protective of its students and families. All right, I beg your pardon for the interruption of this Indie Week broadcast. And I'm back with you now to go to the Raleigh City Council candidates, the at-large candidates. This is a long article, and we'll see how much of it I can fit in. The city of Raleigh has changed how it elects its 8-member city council, and for the first time ever this year, it's holding a nonpartisan primary election. That's on March the 3rd for all seats for which more than 2 candidates have filed to run. The council's 2 at-large seats and a District C seat feature competitive primary races. All Raleigh voters will vote for 2 candidates in the 6-candidate at-large race, and District C voters will vote for 1 of 4 candidates in that primary. The top 4 vote-getting candidates will advance to the at-large general election in November, as will the top 2 vote-getters in District C. In the general election, the mayor's seat and all city council seats will appear on the ballot. All of those races are competitive except District B, where the incumbent councilmember Megan Patton is running unopposed. With at-large councilmember Jonathan Lambert Milton leaving the city council to run for 1 of 2 new at-large seats on the Wake County Board of Commissioners, Raleigh is guaranteed to have at least 1 new member on council in 2027. Going forward, City Council members will serve four-year staggered terms starting next year for the mayor, District A and B council member, and the at-large council candidate who gets the most votes in November, and they will serve through 2030. An election in 2028 will see council members elected again in districts C, D, and E, and that other at-large seat, with their terms lasting through 2032. Over the last month, Indy spoke with the six candidates running for the two at-large seats about their backgrounds and priorities, what they think sets them apart from other candidates, and the big ideas they want to bring to the city council. Early voting for the primary begins today, February the 12th. Voters, check your registration, view sample ballots, and find their polling places. If you look, there is a link on the IndyWeek.com website, but you could probably find the Board of Elections for Wake County or the City of Raleigh. Candidates for the City Council at-large seats, and I will be excerpting some of this information. Clark Reinhardt, a Miami native, industrial engineer, has lived in Raleigh for 17 years to study theology at Duke Divinity School. A current resident of District C, he pastored a church in North Raleigh for nearly a decade before holding community building and social entrepreneurship roles across the triangle, including with the Loading Dock, Innovate Raleigh, and the Chapel Hill Downtown Partnership. Reinhardt said the intersection of community engagement, community development, and economic development that is a feature of his professional life positions him well to listen and learn from Raleigh's communities and, quote, figure out how to get folks as many living wage jobs as possible so they have the kind of opportunities that a lot of us dream of for ourselves and our neighborhoods. His council priorities: housing affordability, public safety, infrastructure, and entrepreneurship culture. Big idea: work with clergy, elected leaders, and other partners to use church-owned parcels of land for the community's benefit. There's a lot more of this I will not elaborate on for just purposes of getting through more than one article today. Cameron Zamot, Z-A-M-O-T, the founder of the Bike Library, a cafe and bike rental company that opened in Boylan Heights, Raleigh, in July. The youngest candidate for the at-large seat and the newest to Raleigh. And with a military background, District D resident, has lived and traveled all over the world. And in Raleigh, he worked for a stint in the city's transportation department. He said his work in Raleigh feels like I'm planting something in soil where it can grow. Everything I've tried so far to get going in Raleigh, whether it's the bike library or weekly ride or nonprofit, has seemed to find roots in some way or another. Whereas in other places, I have tried to start things and it feels like I'm planting something in sand or in rocks. It doesn't feel like that here. He lists his priority: affordable living and walkable neighborhoods, fewer traffic deaths, transit, quote, that takes you where you need to go, and improved communication among city staff and elected officials. Big ideas: make UDO text changes, that's the Unified Development Ordinance, to create more diverse, mixed-income neighborhoods, and implement a zonal service transit system. He advocates transitioning from a hub-and-spoke model for Raleigh's bus service to a zonal service, or point-to-point system. In the hub-and-spoke model, all service routes through one of a few central hubs, like in Raleigh, the Go Raleigh station downtown. Then, Sana Siddiqui. In the 26 years she's lived in Raleigh, she's graduated from North Carolina State, built a product management career in the manufacturing industry, started a small business, was one of the original founders of the first Friday movie night and market that's now run in partnership with the city of Raleigh, and volunteered on the city's Hispanic and Immigrant Affairs Board, Environmental Advisory Board, and Human Relations Commission. All of that experience, she says, has given me a good understanding of what it's like to live in the city, how the city works, where things may get stuck, and where are the challenges, what needs to be done better. I've worked directly with people across the city from different backgrounds, so I get to see challenges that different communities have. She lists as her priorities small businesses, growth, neighborhoods and housing, support for city staff, and community engagement. Big ideas include bring together leaders from different communities. She says she wants to find a way, potentially through Raleigh's restored system of Citizen Advisory Council, CACs, to engage leaders from different residents' communities and, quote, bring them to the table, get them to care about city operations and opportunities so they can get people within their communities to care. I'm an immigrant, she says, and I'm involved with my faith-based community. I'm involved with my cultural communities, and many of those people are very disconnected. I have a lot of friends from Latino community. I know they're disconnected overall. They do things as a community, but there's a disconnect when it comes to engaging with the city or getting their feedback. Another priority, support small businesses and revisit housing affordability incentives to create more mixed-income neighborhoods. Then we have Joshua Bradley, the only self-described socialist and Green Party candidate in the race. Joshua Bradley is a District A resident and frequent public commenter at City Hall, embarking on his fourth run for a Raleigh City Council seat. In 2024, running at large, Bradley placed sixth out of seven candidates. He's motivated by a desire to be a voice for Raleigh's worker and low-income and unhoused residents, saying there needs to be somebody with a conscience in there. People say, well, business needs a seat at the table, but business owns the table, right? It'd be nice to have the workers represented, the people that are otherwise or generally ignored. Priorities for Bradley: housing justice, racial justice and equity, workers' rights, environmental justice, non-discrimination, and community inclusion. Big ideas. Prioritize building affordable housing on city-owned land and expand housing services. Fully fund the Crisis Alternative Response for Empathy and Support. That's the CARES program, which has been operational now for a few years. And he endorses that program and wants to expand it. Then, a 20-year veteran of the U.S. Army, James Bledsoe, is running for the at-large seat for that third consecutive election cycle. He made a run for the Raleigh District C seat in 2017. While he has run on a conservative platform in the past, Bledsoe is running as a registered Republican for the first time this year. After serving three tours of combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, he retired from the military last May. He has worked in IT roles for the state of North Carolina for 14 years, pursuing a bachelor's degree now in criminal justice. He wants to fully audit the city's budget, eliminate wasteful spending, such as spending on art for police and fire station, and pay off the city's debt. I would love to start fixing things around here without raising taxes. His priorities: affordability and the housing shortage, infrastructure improvements, public safety, and support for first responders and veterans. Big ideas: work with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on these infrastructure improvements. Lobby the General Assembly for a property tax relief program for long-time homeowners. Bring back the city's Veterans Day Parade. Then, Stormy Forte, the only incumbent in the race and the top vote-getter in the at-large election in 2024. She has served on the City Council since 2020 and is a licensed attorney and a principal at a consulting service provider that assists business with economic development opportunities. As a guardian ad litem for the state, she also provides legal representation to children involved with social service cases. I want to convey to folks I'm happy to serve on the council. The Raleigh native and current District D resident said, being the first black female to serve on the city council, being a member of the LGBTQ community as well, provides a diversity experience, but also diversity of perspective, which is important to have on the council. Priorities: affordable housing accessibility, efficient public transit, city infrastructure improvements, and economic development for small businesses. Big idea: bring a Major League Baseball team to Raleigh. And that's the many paragraphs associated with that. She's an avid sports fan. And that concludes this article. And I left out some details just to provide what their big ideas were and a substantive capsule of what the Indie Week has to say about their interviews. All right, I'm under the 20-minute mark left in this broadcast from Indie Week. I will change now from the very, very long background articles on candidates. There will be time to reconvene, re-meet those in weeks to come. Just again, IndieWeek.com is a free online website which is concerned with exactly the sort of story I'm reading to you. Many of them have photos, of course, graphic materials that are useful, charts, etc., that I can't portray in speech. At least I'm not competent to do it. All right, so I'm going to move now to the city of Durham, which is going to test out a day shelter with homelessness services. That's underway for the unhoused population after many years of planning. Last week, the Board of County Commissioners authorized the manager to sign a one-year contract with Urban Ministries of Durham, that's UMD, which will operate a day shelter and service center as a pilot program and approved funding for it during its meeting on February the 9th, just a few days ago. Durham's existing shelters offer a place for the homeless population to stay during the night, leaving people to seek out other areas like libraries during the day. The day shelter will provide a gap in existing services, fill a gap, I'm sure they mean, offering access to washers and dryers, showers, internet, charging stations, and mail during the day. It will also house services to help people exit homelessness, offering case management and resource navigation, behavioral health support, and workforce development. The day shelter will give homeless Durhamites a place to go and access resources in between those shelter stays, said Director of UMD Sheldon Mitchell, but it won't take away from UMD's existing services, which provide shelter, food, and clothes to those in need. The pilot program will allow UMD to add 4 people to its staff to run the day shelter and service center. It will operate in the community cafe of UMD's current building downtown, said Mitchell, with UMD prepared to host 25 to 30 neighbors at one time. The contract gives UMD until May to get the shelter up and running, but Mitchell said he expects it to be operational by April the 1st. The day shelter will be open from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday for 39 consecutive weeks. And Mitchell said this is going to be an opportunity to bring such a resource to the community, especially at a time when issues are more and more challenging, and it seems like the need for such a service is critical. Wendy Jacobs, a Durham County Commissioner, said the need for a day shelter in Durham has been apparent for a very long time. She said this is a moment in time when a lot of different things are coming together in a really good way in Durham, in terms of addressing and strengthening our homelessness service system. Durham has explored the idea of a day shelter for a few years, she said. In 2021, the county received American Rescue Plan Act funds to expand homelessness service. Jacobs advocated for putting $350,000 toward a day shelter. Approval of this shelter also comes as city and county are in the final stages of developing a strategic plan to end homelessness, and with the city moving homeless service under the Community Safety Department last year, Jacobs noted. That pilot program has two goals: to create an easily accessible place for shelter during the day and support Durham's homeless population in moving toward stable housing. Jacobs said it will be important to see how the shelter helps Durham's diverse and unhoused population, and it won't be a one-size-fits-all solution. Quote, there's a whole spectrum of people, and what is not acceptable is for people to be living out in the woods or on the streets of our community or having to just find shelter in our libraries. That is not acceptable. I'm very hopeful that the day center is really going to make a difference in us helping to solve this problem in our community and care for people in the way they deserve and need to be cared for. According to city data, 1,400 Durhamites were experiencing homelessness as of December 31st. From 2024-5, UMD reported housing 636 people in its shelter, serving over 260,000 meals and distributing 144,000 pounds of food. That same UMD report found there has been a 300% increase in unsheltered homelessness in Durham since 2018. UMD's current emergency shelter serves about 100 people each night, housing single men and women, along with its 9 family rooms, said Mitchell. The nonprofit also offers a food pantry and clothing closet, in addition to a community cafe that serves 3 meals a day, 7 days a week. These services will continue as the day shelter becomes operational. Mitchell said UMD is hoping to provide enrichment services like substance education classes, health awareness sessions, or job resources for that day shelter. And he said UMD will work with community partners like Open Table Ministries to provide them. In June of 2025, UMD lost 2 federal grants, causing the shelter to lay off 7 full and part-time employees so it could maintain all its services. Those cuts came 1 month after UMD proposed a plan to the Durham County Commissioners to expand its services to a new multi-floor building. Despite the cuts, UMD is still planning to expand. Mitchell said there is a strong need for newer facilities so that UMD can offer non-congregate emergency shelter for individuals and a more properly designed space for its other services. Mitchell said that after the contract is up, UMD would like to continue offering the day shelter. I have a great expectation we'll be able to continue this after the pilot, said Mitchell, and eventually that this will begin either a standalone sort of program that's offered in community, or it will be part of a bigger planned new facility for urban ministries. Samantha Smith, the Homeless Service Special Projects Coordinator for Durham County, said there have been multiple requests from local government committees and Durham's downtown business community to create a day shelter and service center. Smith said the city and county's new strategic framework to prevent and end homelessness is centered on achieving a July 2031 goal of functional zero, meaning moving more homeless Durhamites to stable housing than are entering or staying in homelessness on a monthly basis. One step to the plan is offering the day shelter, and Smith said, we're early on in this process. And so at this point, our goal is to get this sort of first step up and running. This first step of the day shelter and service center, have it run well, track its success, and then we'll have those future conversations about possible expansion. Next article by Jane Porter, which is datelined yesterday, 2/11, February 11th of 26. Chatham considers moratorium. Wake County residents are continuing opposition to a proposed data center in Apex. As residents of One Triangle community have organized in opposition to a plan for a large data storage facility in unincorporated Wake County for nearly half a year, the leaders of another Triangle adjacent community are considering a year-long ban on any new data center proposals. Today, Chatham County, that is to say on the 11th, Chatham's County Board of Commissioners will hold a public hearing, quote, to consider a temporary moratorium on the permitting of data centers, processing facilities, cryptocurrency mining operations, and any other associated uses within the unincorporated areas of Chatham County. That's according to the agenda description for the special session. A vote is expected to immediately follow the hearing, with an ordinance going into effect today if the moratorium is approved. It comes as the rise of artificial intelligence is accelerating demand for large data centers across the state, leaving local governments largely unprepared to manage their rapid water and energy-intensive expansion. That's not to mention the close proximity of Chatham County's eastern border to the proposed 190-acre Wake County data center site. According to the agenda, county leaders will decide whether to give county planners time to study the impact of data centers, develop regulations to mitigate negative impacts, and draft a legislative text amendment to the county's planning documents. And the county cites, quote, considerable amounts of water and energy usage as a necessity for the moratorium. The scope of the ban includes any proposed facility associated with AI, computing and modeling, cryptocurrency mining, web service and hosting, and genome sequencing. Meanwhile, residents of Western Wake County continue to pressure Apex town leaders to reject a proposal for what's being marketed as the New Hill Digital Campus by Maryland-based developer Natelli Investments, LLC. The developer would have to receive annexation and a rezoning from the town to build the 300-megawatt facility. Last month, across two work sessions spanning more than 5 hours, Apex town staff presented information on data centers to members of the town planning board and town council, covering everything from energy and water consumption, noise and environmental impacts, land use and regulatory requirements, to how such a facility could impact traffic, fire response, and public safety. Town officials had the opportunity to ask questions, express concerns, and request more information. While much of that information presented wasn't new, town staff, including fire and police chief, raised concerns to the council about their department's capabilities in regard to the facility. Data centers are relatively fire-safe, Apex Fire Chief Tim Herman said. He said research from town staff found there have only been 22 fires in the 12,000-some facilities around the world between 2014 and 23, and no major disasters. But the area proposed for the data center is currently underserved and in need of a fire station. A new station is planned for construction beginning in 2030. From the police department's perspective, concerns were less technical but more wide-ranging. Police Chief Ryan Johansson said the police department would be tasked with protecting the community in the event of demonstrations or protests against the facility, noting that town meetings where the data center is under discussion already require a heightened police presence. Johansson said the department would have to conduct increased security checks and risk assessment with federal partners, as a large data center could be a potential target for terrorism. And Johansson raised concerns about the accessibility of such a facility to local law enforcement, saying these companies are very protective of data And so getting access for emergency responders on the regular has traditionally been very difficult. And the police department would be tasked with dealing with all data center related calls about noise or suspicious activities. He said, I just have to acknowledge that anything new like this coming in increases the workload, and we're all pretty well strapped. There are a number of things that maybe we don't think of as being directly associated with the data center, but which are likely to increase costs for service. At the Apex Town Council's regular meeting on Tuesday evening, residents responded to some of the information presented at the work session, especially related to utilities use and environmental impacts, with skepticism. One resident, Michelle Hoffner O'Connor, accused the town and Atelli Investments LLC of understating the proposed water usage, energy consumption, and air pollution output. She said, I don't necessarily believe misrepresentations of information that come from our town are malicious, but it does beg the question, who are the real subject matter experts being consulted? Who is performing review to verify what is said? The data center is also emerging as an issue in the upcoming Democratic primary for the 4th Congressional District, with much of Western Wake County, including Apex, newly drawn into the incumbent Representative Valerie Fouché's Durham Center District. Some residents have asked Fouché and the four other candidates running in the primary to oppose the New Hill Digital Campus, quote, and any other potential data centers that could be built in the district, in an open letter and petition that 260 people so far have signed. Further, we urge all five of you to reject any donations or super PAC support from the big tech lobby, especially AI executives and companies, states the letter. In 2022, a cryptocurrency billionaire who was later convicted of fraud and campaign violations spent $1 million to sway this race. This cycle, we must feel confident that our Congress member, regardless of party or ideology, will put our community's interests above those of corporations or billionaires who could stand to profit from this or any other center's impacts on our neighbors. So far, Fouché has not taken a position on the data center proposal specifically, noting that whether to approve it will be a question decided at the local level. Fouché's top opponent, Durham County Commissioner Nida Alam, has gone on the record opposing the digital campus and large data facilities in general. Alam's campaign has attempted to make the connection between Fouché and the industry that's accelerating this rapid expansion of facilities across the country. Fouché is a member of a bipartisan U.S. House Task Force on AI. But last year, Fouché received just $1,000 each from Google and Meta in a haul totaling $350,000, according to the latest campaign finance reporting. Fouché received $30,000 from PACs affiliated with tech companies in her past two congressional runs. Still, the opposition is real. More than 4,500 people have signed a change.org petition opposing the data center, with most of them appearing to be local. And data centers are an issue elected officials at all levels will increasingly have to navigate. Fouché said at a recent candidate forum, in response to a question about balancing the potential higher energy costs and advances in technology that are driving them, quote, I do believe that your local representatives understand it is essential that everything they consider has to be what is the benefit for the citizens in their community. While we're talking about how we set up guardrails, what we want, what we make by way of framework to AI has to be where data centers can or should be located. What I don't want Congress to do is preempt what a local government decides for itself. Well, with just about 2 minutes left, I will move to a woefully short recounting of an article about a new version of the play Macbeth at the Playmakers Repertory Theater at the during most of March, actually, in Chapel Hill. There's a Chapel Hill couple playing the Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, and they're Ron Menzel and Vivian Benesch. "We like to think of it as couples therapy," actor Ron Menzel said with a laugh. He was referencing his upcoming lead in Macbeth alongside his wife, who will take the stage as Lady Macbeth during this upcoming run. "A couple sees all sides," Benesch said over a recent video call. "The good, the bad, the ugly. I feel like we got a head start in understanding how to be intimate with each other, challenge each other, and accept the best and the worst of each other." The play also marks the first time that Benesch, who served as a producing artistic director at Playmakers for a decade, will act in a company production. Though as she relayed this information, Menzel was quick to jump in with praise. "I think it's worth mentioning she is an Obie Award-winning actor and has performed on Broadway." Such gentle rapport suggests that Menzel and Benesch probably are not in great need of couples therapy, when also makes the prospect of seeing them portray as literature's most doomed power couple all the more intriguing. The balance of this article is an interview with the two actors, and I will have to forego that because we're approaching the end of my recording period for Indie Week. Well, as I said, this is for Macbeth, which will be performed at the Gillings Center for Dramatic Art and between March the 4th and March the 22nd. And there's no more time to read this. You can find it again, as I've mentioned before, indieweek.com in the arts section, along with many, many other articles that I have not been able to get to today even. So they'll be put in my backlog file, which I sometimes get to. John Fetterson now for the North Carolina Reading Service. This program, after this Friday debut, will be a podcast with that one regrettable one-minute silence in the middle, which I do beg your pardon again for. Anyway, from the ncreadingservice.org, so long for this week.